welcome to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Aaron DeBlasey will be telling us a little bit about Access Information News.
So what can you tell me about Access Information?
Well, the newsletter itself or just Access Information in general?
A little of both.
Okay. I started life with a diagnosis at 7 years old of chronic nephrolithiasis, which in layman's terms is kidney stones, but they were really bad. I've passed about 500 in my lifetime. So, and I've had 4 or 5 surgeries to remove them. And this kind of pressed me in a direction of having to deal with doctors in a way that is not always the most positive and beneficial. So this led me to meet a man named Larry Lewis in 2004 during my martial arts training, who was blind. I was a martial arts instructor for 18 years. I had never taught a man who was blind before, but I taught Larry, and for 3.5 years, he and I became friends, and I learned the blind community and the needs that they had. And being an engineer myself and being a digital marketer myself, Larry and I got together, and we did a couple of projects together. He founded a company called Flying Blind LLC in 2004, since dissolved, and had a man named Dean Martin now, who started a newsletter called Top Tech Tidbits, which is currently the largest assistive technology newsletter in the world. At the time, Dean Martin had the newsletter. He started it out in Outlook. It grew very quickly. He came to Larry and said, "Larry, I can't send it out in Outlook anymore. You know, what do I do?" And Larry says, "I know a guy," and I was that guy. So Larry and I sat down, we put our heads together, and we turned the newsletter that Dean had produced into a newsletter that could be sent all across the world. Compliant, legal, opt-out, opt-in, you know, you get the idea, spam house, etc. And it grew very quickly, up to 6,500 subscribers. These were mostly blind people at the time. We had not yet hedged into persons with disabilities. It was primarily a blind assistive technology newsletter. And Larry funded it, to his credit, God love him, to the tune of about $2,500 a month for, I don't know, 13 or 14 years. And he eventually needed an exit strategy. And he tried to shop it around the community. No one really knew what to do with it. And that's not surprising, because there's no real marketing infrastructure in the disability community. So he was going to basically drop it in the trash can, and I said, "Let me go to Mind Vault," which was my company at the time, and I went to the board, and I said, "Look, you know, we have a chance to do something really good here." You know, they said, "Aaron, we'll give you 2 years. We'll fund it for 2 years. If you can get it to pay for itself, it can stay around." And that was obviously 2020, so I was able to do that in about a year and a half. We had 12 sponsors that made the newsletter possible for ongoing distribution. In 2022, the newsletter grew so large that we were including now medical, legal breakthroughs, opinion editorials, and these were not specifically assistive technology news. And rightfully, readers, you know, wrote in and said, "Aaron, you know, please don't, you know, get that out of the newsletter. That's not what Top Tech Tidbits is." And they were right. So we spun off Access Information News. And Access Information News is basically everything that is not hardcore assistive technology news. Medical breakthroughs, legal breakthroughs, and opinion editorials about how disabled and blind readers feel about particular technologies and services, and, you know, all very important viewpoints, but not to be clouded with Top Tech Tidbits, just giving you the tip, you know, the tips that you need to get through your week, so to speak, I guess, was the idea. So Access Information News was born in 2022, and we cloned the list at that time, and at that time, I think the list was maybe 25,000 people. And since then, they have differentiated substantially. They're both still, ironically, at about 43,000 subscribers per week. They continue to grow at the same rate. So I think pretty much everyone who reads one reads the other. They just didn't want to read them together.
So,
and yeah, go ahead.
So how do you reach out to folks who could potentially benefit from the information you're presenting?
How do we reach out? Well, we reach out to them every week by email. We have an email list. And that list is 43,000 strong currently for Access Information News and 43,000 strong for Top Tech Tidbits. So basically what we do, we don't produce news ourselves. We aggregate it for the community. So we partner with creators like Sam of the Blind Life, Double Tap, all of the major creators, Carry On Accessibility, anyone that you could name in the community that makes good content for blind and disabled people, we partner with them. And we carry their news every week as an aggregate, because anywhere else you go to get a newsletter, if you get Acme Corporation's newsletter, it's often just Acme Corporation's news, not everyone else's news. And people want one place to go to get trusted disability and blind low vision related news in a single place every single week. And that's what we've been providing since 2004.
So since the inception, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Wow, quite a few. I would say maybe Elegant Insights comes to mind. I believe her name is Laura Legendary. She was a sponsor of ours. Her mother had cancer. She was taking care of her. And she mentioned to me, Aaron, my sponsorship, which she got at the time, was very cheap. And we keep the sponsorships the same price for people when they come on. She said it allowed her to stay in the hospital and take care of her mother and brought in the sales that she needed. And that there was nothing like this in the disability community, and that it was about time, because this is the same thing that mainstream people take advantage of all the time, you know, but we don't have it available to us. So that's something that we're trying to do, is make that available to business owners, blind business owners, disabled business owners. You know, we partner with Disability Inn, Dr. Kirk Adams, all of the major players in employment, you know, that try to get blind and disabled people into positions.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for equality and the right to access information and just resources, what would you say?
I would say that these two newsletters are all we have right now to keep that alive. And that kind of scares me. We have no competitors. There are a few newsletters out there that are access-specific. I can shout out Jack McElhinney. Accessibility in the News does a great job. But nothing as rigorous, I think, as what we do each week with Access Information News or Top Tech Tidbits. And these need to carry on beyond us. You know, even when we leave, I think these publications need to stay in the communities that they serve forever. Frankly, I mean, depending upon how technology heads, but that's my opinion.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Sean Wiltshire will be sharing his insights as to how folks with disabilities cope with changes in the workplace. So when it comes to changes in the workplace, how do folks with disabilities typically respond? I mean, personnel changes, I've got to imagine that there'd be some mental health strain, if nothing else.
Sure. You know, Cam, one of the changes, you know, change at work isn't hard because of a disability. It's hard because of the uncertainty. One of the first things kind of I think we need to talk about in this conversation is that most everybody would struggle with change at work. New supervisors, new expectations, maybe you've got added responsibility. You know, and that uncertainty is stressful for everybody. For folks with disabilities, that stress can sometimes be amplified, not because they can't do the job, but because the support or the routine or those informal understandings that those staff or leadership may have may suddenly change and disappear. It's not the support itself that's the hardest. It's not knowing what the change means for that person. So how will the change affect my job and the supports I rely on? So it's a fairly common not understanding, but it can be amplified for folks with disabilities.
So do you have any advice on coping strategies someone with, say, autism could use to sort of keep a cool head and just focus on the job?
Absolutely, right. So, you know, we often hear about folks, you know, they're coping with the change or, you know, things like that. Well, when people hear coping, they imagine, you know, sort of you're really strong. But in reality, people with disabilities cope with change by changing the systems around them. So it's the understanding that the disability that you have may mean that you find a different way to work. You ask for the expectations in writing, which is extremely helpful for somebody who's neurodiverse. Gives them clear understanding of the expected outcomes and when they're supposed to happen. You know, it's also really important that if there is a change at work and you have a new supervisor, make sure that they have an opportunity to observe how you work before modifying your tasks. It's an understanding that, you know, it's renegotiating check-in schedules. It's advocating for yourself. Now, I always say to people that, you know, self-advocacy is needed most when there are transitions, and that's when it's actually the hardest to do. So new people that come on to the employer or maybe who are supervising you now, they don't know your strengths. And, you know, folks often feel that it might be difficult to ask for support. But what we need to do is we need to normalize that. Every time there's a staff turnover, people feel like they have to re-explain or re-justify accommodations, and that's exhausting and takes away from the work. So it's a real important idea that what you need to have is consistent communication, permission to ask questions without sort of that penalty so that the understandings are clear, and time to adapt before being evaluated. If they're adding extra duties or changing your duties, there is an adaptation time. So, you know, you can really sum this up with most people don't need less challenge. They need fewer surprises. And, you know, people with disabilities adapt all the time. What makes the biggest difference is whether the workplace adapts with them.
So that being said, supposing it's someone coming in who's on an equal footing to the worker with the disability, do you have any thoughts as to how they can sort of open those conversations and say, yeah, I might do the work this way as opposed to ways you've seen it done in the past, but it still proves just as effective?
And I think that this is one of the things about sharing sort of our skill set, not the disability. So it's giving people the insight into how you do the work. The same conclusion, but you might process it a little differently. One of the examples I often think of is folks who are neurodiverse are really good at sort of identifying patterns and finding sort of that missing number in a big spreadsheet because they see things and process things differently. That I would consider a skill if you are somebody who has spent a lot of time reviewing spreadsheets or other financial documents. It's giving people the understanding that being neurodiverse or having a disability doesn't take away skill. It very often adds skill. But we as a society haven't figured out that where we get a new viewpoint is where we solve problems. And this is why we always say, you know, people who think differently are better problem solvers. And so it's this idea, Cam, that if you're neurodiverse, if you have ADHD, if you have other mental health concerns, there are always other ways that you exceed expectations. This is not a deficit. This is a processing difference. So it's always start from the asset point of view, and that your skill is important. How you get to the end of the question, how you do that process is sometimes irrelevant if you get the same answer. So we always want to encourage people to identify their skill first, not their deficit.
So have you seen any success moments or examples of this proving especially effective in a workplace scenario?
Absolutely. I can give you two really big examples. And these were interesting ones because they were large organizations. One is the federal government. It's Revenue Canada. And we worked with a gentleman who's an accountant and has autism, lives on the spectrum. And he had struggled to maintain employment. And we worked with him for a number of months, about 19. But he moved from income support to a job inside Revenue Canada where they acknowledged that they had to change or adapt the physical pieces of the workplace, turn his chair around or a desk. And then there was an opportunity for him to apply for a position where he could work from home. So we considered it an understanding that he was hired because his skills were good, and they adapted to make sure that they got the most out of those skills. But again, that's a large corporation. That's a good example of how one process can help many, many people across the department. But we also see folks in smaller employers being able to bring a different viewpoint to a process where the employer goes, I never thought of it that way, or I didn't see it that way. And we've also found that people want to shop at businesses and be engaged with organizations that reflect the community they live in. So that includes folks with disabilities, seniors, young people. It's not just one section of society. Accessibility and inclusion have to be a really broad statement. It just doesn't include folks with disabilities. So, you know, it's the idea here that businesses can have better employees, folks can have better jobs if we just started to understand that when we work together to say we have skill, people understand that the skill is valuable.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks. Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
If you could save a life one day, would you? In Ontario, there are over 1,600 people waiting for a life-saving organ transplant right now. Every 3 days, one of these people will die while waiting. By taking just 2 minutes to register as an organ donor, you can save up to 8 lives and transform 75 more through tissue donation. What you decide to do today has the power to make a lasting impact. Join millions of other registered organ donors in Ontario and give hope to those waiting. Register at beadonor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about Access Information News
from Aaron DeBlasi.
And Sean Wiltshire shared some insights about how individuals with disabilities cope with changes at work. In this segment of our show, Alec Dennis will be giving us an update on his disability support work. So the last time we talked, you told me a little bit about your disability sports journey. What's the latest on that?
What's the latest on that? Well, I guess the latest is we just finished our curling season, so I'm going to have to find something else to do this summer. So mostly what I do in the summertime is I've got a fairly big property here, 4.5 acres, so I got lots of gardens, flower and vegetable gardens to look after. So I'm looking forward to starting that once the weather gets better. And I also do hand cycling as just a recreational thing to do. I do that 3 or 4 times a week.
So for those who might have missed our prior interview, could you kind of recap some of your story?
Sure, just a short recap. I was injured in 1979, quite a while ago, and suffered a compression fracture of the spine, which left me paralyzed basically from the waist down. And since that time, in 4 months, I returned to work. I was working with the Ministry of Natural Resources as a forester. So I continued that work when I returned to work in 4 months. And I also got involved at the same time in sports for the physically disabled. So I started off doing a lot of sports, wheelchair basketball. I did field events, track events. Also did archery and air pistol shooting and swimming. And swimming was my strongest suit for the first couple of years, but because of the lack of training facilities, I was located in a small town that didn't have a swimming pool, so I had to travel a fair distance to get to a swimming pool. I decided that I would be better off picking up a sport that's something that I could practice at home. And because I was working full-time as well, I needed to have flexibility when to practice, so I took up archery as my one sport to focus on, and very successful in that. I went to 5 different Paralympic Games, starting in 84, ending in 2000. And then I retired from archery in 2017 after the World Championships in China, in Beijing. So that was sort of my sport journey. Then I got involved in recreational sports just locally. That included sledge hockey, skating, skiing, paranordic skiing, and also wheelchair curling.
So in your time in disability sport, what sorts of benefits have you experienced? I'd imagine being out in the community and being among other athletes is one of them. But going beyond that,
I think the biggest benefit is that, you know, after a traumatic injury like suffering a spinal cord injury, you really do lose a lot of self-esteem and self-confidence, and not knowing exactly what you can be. You're being, you know, I remember I was very shy and hesitant about going out because I was always worried about, you know, whether it was going to be accessible, the facility or the building I was going to, whether it was going to be accessible, how I would do, you know, how I'd be perceived as somebody with a disability in a wheelchair. So sports really got me out of that. It certainly built up a lot of self-confidence and self-esteem. You know, when you start doing something and practicing it and doing it well, you really do build up your self-esteem and your self-confidence again. The other thing, of course, was social connections. And one of the things that I find with people that have a disability is they become socially isolated very, very quickly. Just because you're different, you don't feel like you fit in. So sports, like archery, is a very integrated sport. I do that with able-bodied athletes all the time. And same thing with wheelchair curling. I curl with able-bodied teams where all the other players on my team are able-bodied. So it does really provide that integration that you really need after a traumatic injury.
So do you have any advice for young athletes out there who might be asking, with my disability, can I still be a part of sport?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things I do. I'm a peer mentor with Spinal Cord Injury Ontario. And that's my suggestion to most people I meet, is to get involved in a sport. There's lots of adaptive equipment. So you can participate in just about any kind of sport that's out there now. You know, that's available to the able-bodied. It's also available to people with disabilities. And sometimes there's adaptive rules. For instance, in tennis, if you play tennis in a wheelchair, the adaptive rule is that instead of just one bounce, you're allowed to have two bounces of the ball, which gives you a little bit more time, you know, to maneuver your wheelchair to hit the ball back. In archery, the only difference is that I'm allowed to stay on the line after I finish shooting. I don't have to step back from the line the 10 feet that the other archers do. I can stay on the line. So those are really some adaptive rules, but there's also adaptive equipment. For instance, paranordic skiing, you ski on a sled. So I'm skiing sitting down on a sled, but it has regular skis on it that just attach to the frame of my sled. So there is, you know, for anybody that has an injury, I very strongly suggest they get into sports, because, as I said, it's a way of integrating back into the able-bodied community, building up self-confidence, self-esteem.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
You bet.
Thanks. My friends, thinking back on Sean's interview, a worker with a disability has every right to know what the situation is in their work setting. They tend to appreciate the role they're given more than most. They do tend to get established in their ways of doing things. Unfortunately, that's a side effect of the fact that many people with disabilities aren't given the same opportunities, or at least perceive that they aren't. But the fact is, if there's a change at work, be it management, be it a coworker, what have you, that should never interfere with a person with a disability's opportunities to advance or their right to do productive and meaningful work. Yeah, it's great a company can get people in the door, but then what? You have to ask the question of, can this person reasonably expect to succeed, not only given the workload, but given the attitudes and understanding of those around them? Companies definitely want a seamless flow of work product, and a large part of that is an understanding sometimes you're going to be working with someone with a disability. Their way of doing things isn't necessarily your way, but it's not necessarily better or worse. If it gets the job done, let them get the job done. Be a source of support. Maybe you might even learn something from their insights. Truth of the matter is, any company, any organization that stagnates does not have a longevity in this world. I've always maintained persons with disabilities are stronger as a united presence. And whether it be a work situation, a church situation, school, home life, community life, what have you, a person with a disability has both the right and the obligation to be a part of things. And I say obligation because a person with a disability is doing themselves no favors by staying out of things, by letting others' ideas and methods be the only voices that are heard. Honestly, they don't need the shoe print on their forehead. And there comes a point where a person with a disability, like anyone, if they feel they're not heard, they simply stop speaking up. And that's a loss to all of us. For changes in the workplace, they can be a difficult thing. They can be an unsettling transition. But they can also be a great opportunity. Working together, establishing that understanding, that trust, maybe even that friendship, you can create something greater for the future. Disability policies in a workplace, they must evolve. They should never stop. They should never get to a place where we say, that's good enough. We've done our jobs. We've got this in place. There's upkeep. There's monitoring. There's periodic checking whether those needs are actually being met. Doing something on paper is not the same as putting it into practice, my friends. But making sure that in times of transition, that the person with a disability knows their role, knows what is expected of them, can make this a lot smoother and a lot better for the organization as a whole. Honestly, these are unsettling times for all of us. The economy in particular is in what you might call a rocky, unstable place. But the truth is, we're not going to pull out of that tailspin by adding more uncertainty to the equation. We're going to get out of it by working together, understanding each other's viewpoints, and accepting new ideas. And that, my friends, is the great gift in disability life, the ability to see beyond the obvious, the ability to try, sometimes to stumble, but ultimately to find out what works for us. Disability has never been a one-size-fits-all proposition. It's never been something that you can just say, this is how we solve the problem. Yes, it's one path to a solution, but is it the only path? Disability life is so much like the iceberg. It's a little bit you can see, but it is so much beneath the surface. It's so much a story, an ability to adapt, a source of support, a network of people coming together to help us achieve our best. Recognizing that, you see less the condition. You see more the whole person. You see, there is a living, breathing human being entering the equation. This isn't just someone who plays up their disability while in the public eye. It's not a hat. They don't take it off at night. They don't go home and say, I've gotten all that I need out of society, so I'm just going to go and do what I want to do. This is a part of their lives they carry with them at all times. It can be a source of strength. It can be a set of tools we learn to work with. It's all up to the individual to decide how to embrace the opportunities before them. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
Hello, netizens and loyal listeners of Bitcoover FM every 8 to 10 p.m. Tuesday evenings. This is Connor, host of Bitcoover FM for more than 8 years here on CGSF, and I would not be where I am today without the support of you, dear listeners. My favorite thing about you is that you always challenge me to dig deeper, go back further, pull up even more obscure video game soundtracks than we already do. And I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for continuing to support independent chiptune on the radio.
You're listening to